Do you want more energy, better sleep, and better health? Who wouldn't? Get a free Scalar Light no obligation 15-day trial at scalarlight.com.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. I'm your host Jasmine, and today we have a special guest on the show, Swati Foster. She is one of India's most influential wildlife and conservation presenters, journalist. She's also a scriptwriter, a presenter, and researcher on her own show, Born Wild. We talk about her journey into supporting and protecting South Africa's kelp forests through the Sea Change Project, which produced the documentary My Octopus Teacher, which has won global awards since it was released. Me and Swati talk about why it's so important to be connected to nature in order to help save it, and her own personal journey into the wilderness and what it means to be born wild. Hi Swati, and welcome to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today from South Africa.
Thank you, Yasmin, for having me.
So you are a very inspiring environmental journalist, one of India's best known reporters of the natural world, and done some amazing work about the wild and connecting us as humans to the natural world. So can you tell me about your journey into that field and what inspired you to go into environmental journalism?
So I was really lucky when I was very, very young. My father was very, he loved nature, loved the environment. His best friend was an ornithologist called Siddharth Butch. And Uncle Siddharth actually started taking me out into a forest near my house by the time I was three. He'd take me every weekend, Saturday, Sundays, when I wasn't in school. And he'd take me into this forest, and I learned to identify the birds, and I learned to track a lot of the animals. I learned to identify the trees, the plants. I learned how to be in wild spaces. So by the time I was four or five, I'd already found my very happy place, and that was being out in nature. So I was very lucky that it happened for me when I was so young and I was still, you know, perhaps being formed as a person, that this became so much a part of who I then became as a person. So I would say that everything that I've done just felt like a natural progression in this way, because it's really the space that makes me the happiest. It's the place that gives me the most amount of hope. To me, everybody, if you're living on this planet, you should be a naturalist or an environmentalist, because this is your home, especially today in the world that we live in with the challenges that we face. Right now, Yasmin, you're sitting in summer in London. I'm sure it just feels more horribly hot than most summers have. And we're seeing these terrifying floods in Germany. We've just seen the horrifying heat wave in Canada and Northwest America. And, you know, we know that the climate's completely topsy-turvy. We know that there's immense biodiversity loss. We know that there are all these challenges. And the thing is, it's not like these have all just happened and we found out about it right now. In all the way back when I was a teenager, because I spent so much time in nature, I could see stuff was going horribly wrong. So that is what kind of drove me into the journalism aspect of things, because I was like, as much as I knew things were going wrong, I didn't see the importance that it, you know, what it should deserve. It wasn't there. All the headlines were still around politics, economic, crime, etc. I didn't see environment stories on the news. I wasn't reading enough about the environment in newspapers and magazines. So that kind of drove me to become an environmental journalist, because I was like, I have to get this on the news. I have to make this frontline headline. I need to get this on the front page, you know. So that was what really drove me. But the biggest drive was the inspiration, the hope, the joy I've always felt in nature. And I wanted that to translate that for other people.
And where did you grow up exactly in India?
I grew up in Chennai. It's a little coastal city, used to be called Madras. It's the capital city of the state of Tamil Nadu. So I grew up on the banks of the Bay of Bengal. I grew up in a coastal city. I grew up, the forest that I was referring to is called the Theosophical Society. It's a big bank of green that runs along this river that flows into the Bay of Bengal. It was this wonderful childhood where any time that I was free, I was either in the forest, I was on the beach, or, you know, it was all very outdoors. There was barely, and I'm talking about when I was a child, like almost 50 years ago now, 40 years ago now. Yeah. So, you know, no television, no internet, nothing. So except for books and being out, that was the two big sort of entertainment, if you will. So a lot of my time was spent outdoors, and it was only when it was dark did I come home. And yeah.
That's so incredibly lucky. My childhood was spent mainly like in outskirts of Bristol in the city. And I guess growing up, I then started to realize how different I felt when I went into nature and into the natural world. And that's when I started to appreciate it more. And it's almost because I didn't have that connection when I was a kid, I'm so craving it now. So I guess I'm coming from the opposite perspective, but my main motivation now in my journalism is to try and protect these spaces. And that's what this environment and conservation show is for. It's to talk about our connection with the natural world. And you did a lot about being born wild. I know you had a show called Born Wild that was based in India. Can you explain a bit more about what it means to be born wild and where this kind of came from?
Yeah. So as you said, Yasmin, you know, you grew up on the outskirts in a city. You didn't feel like you had that much access to nature or wild spaces when you were a child. And that now as an adult, you crave it and you need it. And I personally believe that every child, it's their birthright to have this access to nature, every single child on this planet. Because the reason why I call my show Born Wild and my book Born Wild is because I believe that when you're born wild. When a baby comes kicking and screaming into the world, that act of birth is one of the most primal acts we still have on the planet, no matter how much technology there is around us. We can even put together a baby in a test tube, but you still need a mother's womb to transplant the baby into, and you still need for that baby to be birthed. Could even be a cesarean section, it doesn't matter. It is a very, very primal, very wild activity still to give birth. And so that creature, that baby, when it comes out, is as born wild as a wolf cub or a shark pup, or, you know, as much as a tiger or a leopard, anything. It's life that tends to domesticate us and tame us down. So for me, I believe that all of us are born wild. And for me, the greatest of truth to this is that we live in the longest gestation period there is, which is Mother Nature. You know, this planet is our womb, and this is the longest gestation period. Everything that we are, the food that we eat, the air that we breathe, you know, the water that we drink, it's all nutrition that's coming to us from the mother. And without her, we will not exist. Without this biosphere, we will not exist. That is how intrinsically entwined we are with the wild. That is how intrinsically we are nature. We're not just a part of nature. We are nature. The way the blood flows through our veins, the fact that we cry salt tears, you know, the same amount of salt as the ocean, the fact that the womb, when we're in the womb, that we grew up in an amniotic sac filled with fluid, like a lot of animals in the ocean are. Now that we live on land, you know, we're almost like amphibious in a sense. You know, there's only, between us and the bonobo, the ape, there's only a 0.1 or point something percentage difference DNA-wise. Between us and the fruit fly, there's less than 20% difference in our genetic code and makeup, you know. So it just, the permutation combinations of life have formed different life forms, but we're all one and we're all part of this magnificent sentient life form and this incredible planet that we're on. So I think that is something we tend to forget when we keep surrounding ourselves with all this artificial stuff. We build homes, we get into cars, we have all this technology. And the more we kind of progress with this technology, we think that we can do without nature. And you just cannot. Because again, you know, you may have nothing to do with nature. You may have never gone out for a walk. You may have never been in the ocean. You may have never set foot in a forest. You may have never left the four walls of your apartment and never have touched anything but concrete, but you're still breathing, you're still eating, you're still drinking water. So you are connected and you are born wild. So for me, that is a very visceral understanding of how this works. And I think that's why it's so key for children from when they're very young to have access to this space. Because why would anybody care? Why should anybody want to protect this space? Why should anybody want to conserve something? Why should anybody want to protect something if they don't know about it, if they don't understand it, if they've never experienced it, if there are so many challenges in their own lives that they're going through? Why would this ever become a priority? And the only way this can become a priority is to have the access, to have the exposure, and to understand just how intrinsically we are entwined.
Completely, yes. I think that perhaps many of the troubles that are coming from the environment right now and the way we treat it and consider it comes from those kind of old thought processes of, like what you said, as we enter into a more artificial kind of age, we stop remembering where this is all coming from. Like, even this laptop that I'm using right now has come from the earth somehow, and everything that I'm looking at and touching at is grown from the earth. So it's about remembering that. And I feel like we're starting to lose that connection to the wild, and it's hard for a lot of people to find that access to nature. So what do you think we need in this modern era to rekindle our connection to the natural world, especially if we live in cities or places that don't have access?
It's incredibly important, firstly, to understand the visceral connection. I think we take it for granted when we breathe, and we take it for granted when we drink water, and we take it for granted when we eat food, because the majority of us on this planet aren't growing the food that we eat. We're not walking to the river and collecting the water that we drink. We are not paying attention to every breath that is going in and out of our body. We're doing all of this and we're taking it for granted. So we're forgetting that visceral connection. That's number one. So to just be aware of one's own body, one's own processes as the human animal, what it takes to keep you alive in this body is the biosphere around us. So it is firstly just to understand that no matter where you live in the world, how you live in the world, what you do in the world, that is what is keeping you alive, not the things around you, but that biosphere. So firstly, understanding that connection. Secondly is, when you're a child, you're actually designed to want to expect nature. That because our primal design is much older than this thin little 2 second veneer of civilization that we've wrapped around us. You know, perhaps we go back 10,000 years to the agricultural revolution, and then less than 2,000 years to the industrial revolution, and less than 100 years really with the technological revolution. But for the rest of the time on the planet prior to that, from when we were modern humans about 350,000 years ago to when we were human-like creatures about 2 million years ago, our DNA is designed and primed to expect to be in nature. So this small amount of time that we've spent sort of creating this artificial world where we've sort of started separating ourselves from nature, thinking that we can control it or impose our will upon her, or in this way that there is this psychological disconnect, not physical, because we wouldn't be alive if we had a physical disconnect from nature, but the psychological disconnect that we've kind of indentured with nature is such a short period of time that it's happened in, but our primal selves are still craving that connect. It is still why when we need to relax, when we need to recover, when we've been ill, when we're sad, when we're happy, whatever it is, you feel so much freer, better, happier, no matter what, when you just step out into a little bit of space that's a bit open, that's a little bit green, that there's a blue sky, there's a blue ocean, there's sand under your feet, your bare feet on the earth, it grounds you. It's something nobody can deny. It makes them feel better.
Yeah.
You know, it's just inbuilt into us to know that that actually makes us feel well. And today, a lot of science, from psychology down to physicality, doctors are telling you that to feel better, to get over stress, to get over, to deal with many, many conditions like depression, anxiety, stress, and all of it, they're recommending that we spend at least 20 minutes a day out in the natural world. And for children trapped in inner cities, for people who don't have the kind of access, because access is also today, unfortunately, in this world, it's become privileged. You know, to have that access has become a very privileged thing. It's only if I don't have to struggle for my next meal, and I don't have to work a 9-to-5 job to make ends meet, and if I don't have to worry about the survival of my family, that do I have the headspace in which to take time to go out into nature. And that's unfortunate that we've set this world up like that, to take away something that should be the, you know, should be the birthright of every single human on the planet. So I would say that if you're in an inner city, just for yourself, even 5 minutes a day, if you spend paying attention to your physicality, paying attention to your breath, just when you take that breath in to understand that it's coming from the natural world around you, to take 5 minutes to understand that even though you're turning on a tap, the water is still coming from a very, very ancient source that's been around since before the time of the dinosaurs. This water is the same water we've had since rain started falling on this planet millions, hundreds of millions of years ago. It's the same water. We're not creating new water. It's the same water that is being recycled. When we eat the food, 80% of everything that we eat has been pollinated by bees and bats and birds and other animals that feed. And they're the ones who are the pollinators. That is how we get to eat food. Without them, there'd be no food and we'd die. The soil, that, you know, that small layer of soil that is on our planet, that's what keeps us alive. It's the bacteria in that soil. It's that soil that allows us to grow things and keeps us alive. So it's understanding all of that. So take 5 minutes a day. And even if you're in inner city, if there is a tree in your neighborhood, a small park in your neighborhood, connect with intent. You know, find out what that tree is. Have you walked by that tree for the last 5 years and you don't even know what that tree is called, what species it is? You know, find out what kind of a tree is it. Is it an oak? Is it a pine? Is it, you know, an evergreen tree? Is it a deciduous tree? What does it look like in autumn? What happens to it in winter? What goes on in spring? What animals live on that tree? What birds come to this tree? How long has this tree been here? How much longer will this tree be here if it's never cut down? In the park that you're in, what other non-human animals occupy the same space as you? Ants on your pavement, you know? Where do they come from? What kind of ants are these? You know, what is their society like? They have complicated, intricate, involved lives. It's just changing your thinking for 5 minutes. You know, get out of your own head. Get out of your own stuff. Own challenges. Just even that 5 minutes frees up something in the human mind that's designed to think like this, designed to be in nature and think like this. And especially incredibly crucial for children. You know, it's really one of the most important things for children. So I am not saying that it isn't a challenge for a lot of people on this planet. But even if there could be that 5 minutes of connection, of understanding, it could change a lot. Because a lot of the rural communities have this connection because most of them are growing their own food. A lot of them know where water comes from. A lot of them are paying attention to the environment around them, to farming communities, for example. They're very, very attuned to the climate. Coastal communities, for example, are very, very attuned to what's going on in the ocean. So a lot of communities already have that access, which is their daily survival access, right? It's inner city kids that I'm worried about. Like when you're trapped in this urban atmosphere and you can recognize more cars and more brands and more t-shirts and more jackets than you can your, you know, the tree in your neighborhood or the bird in your neighborhood. That worries me because what would that mean for us going forward, especially in a world that's so challenged?
It's so true. That's so, that resonates quite strongly from me because I don't know, it came up on my Facebook, this kind of image of all of these brands and then another image of all of these tree leaves. And I could identify more brands than I could of the type of tree. And it told me a lot about how conditioned my brain was to understanding what surrounds me in that kind of way of, it was very telling. And it's so true what you say about the more you start to listen and to read and to become curious by nature, the more I feel it teaches me. And just to become more aware of the cycles and the rhythms of life as well, it's a teacher. And even here in London, we have amazing parks. They feel quite sterile, but the trees in there, some of them are hundreds of years old, and there's always, you know, a tree to go to. So I really do count my blessings with that.
It's also, you know, when you talk about that, when you talked about the brands and the leaves, it's the kind of narrative that is being sold in the world today, which is why storytelling is such a powerful tool. And it's so important what kind of stories get told. Because we as humans are hardwired to listen to stories. Graphs, data, infographics, we tend to switch off. We tend to make decisions, even though we think we're being incredibly logical. 80% of our decisions decisions actually coming from a completely different space in our brains, from our subconscious, from our emotional understanding of things. That's where our decisions are coming from. And all of that is very informed by the stories we are fed. And when I say stories, I mean everything is a story. Your own identity to yourself is a story. You yourself recognize yourself as a story you've told yourself about who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's that intrinsic and that important storytelling. So we live in a world where you're being fed constantly that your happiness lies in how much you can consume. Your happiness lies in that pair of shoes. Your happiness lies in that jacket. Your happiness lies in those dark glasses. Your, you know, if you're depressed, oh, go, you know, go shopping, go do shopping therapy. You know, if you're upset, go like buy yourself something. To make yourself feel better, wear some brand that, you know, some stupid artificial thing that gives you a sense of purpose or sense of self about yourself, because now you're wearing, I don't know, some brand, you know, which has nothing to do with you. It's just, it's this whole story that we've been sold that this is what is the key to happiness. Like work your 9-to-5 job, you know, pay your taxes and whatever little extra money that you have, go buy. In fact, we've reached a stage in life now with this absolutely shocking pattern of unlimited growth, where this economy just thinks it can keep growing. Like there's some infinite ceiling into which it can grow. It's not. The resources are finite, firstly. This planet is a finite space, secondly. And thirdly, there is no such thing as infinite growth. Nothing grows infinitely. Everything dies. There is no such thing as infinity when it comes to things and constructs that we created. We are not infinite. We die, right? So it's a real problem that this is the narrative that's being sold, to a point where today we have countries whose populations are reversing trends, which means there's infertility, birth rates aren't as high as they used to be. And instead of the world going, looking at it and going, you know, perhaps this is a way for humanity to slowly move forward and reduce numbers and therefore reduce burdens on the planet and focus more on people who need help with education and, you know, social help and adopt more instead of having your own children and all of that. The system is telling you, no, we'll come up with ways for you to have more children. Why? Because they need more consumers down the line. They need more of a workforce. They need more people buying stuff. You've created an entire system called the GDP that depends on how much the consumer is spending, you know, so this is the narrative you've been sold. So if you retell the story to the story that you've just told me, where open yourself up to curiosity, step out into nature, look at this biosphere around you. You don't need anything. You don't need to go buy something. You need to watch a sunrise. You need to watch a sunset. You need to get your bare feet into sand. You need to be able to see the stars in the night sky, feel the wind in your hair. Those things, if they become as cool and as important and as sold to you as a story as buying the latest pair of glasses or jeans, we'd live in a completely different world.
Yeah, it's like sometimes we just forget that actually we're humans and yeah, not exactly, just like the consuming machine that's going to just keep on working, buying. And it's about coming out of that and waking up to the fact that we're on this planet for a very short amount of time and life is just going to go like that, you know. And if we don't kind of take ourselves out of that cycle, it's like you've just missed your whole, you're almost living unconsciously to yourself, but also unconscious to the planet that can't sustain that kind of economic model that comes from a theory.
Exactly. And you're also living in a massive moral crisis. Because what we're doing to this planet and what we've done with our systems is, there are millions, hundreds of millions of people on this planet who still go to bed hungry. Hundreds of millions of people on this planet who do not have access to clean water. Hundreds of millions of people on this planet who lose lives and livelihoods to decisions that are made which benefit a small number of people on this planet. So it's also a moral crisis. And the worst part is they are the people who've had the least carbon footprint on this planet, and yet they will be the people who will suffer the biggest repercussions from something like climate change. So, you know, natural rights are human rights. So when we talk about nature and we talk about regenerating nature, when we talk about rewilding, when we talk about protection, when we talk about reconnecting with nature, those are all tied in to human rights. You know, so for me, it's also that. It's that bigger picture of this moral crisis in the way that we live. Every decision that we take is impacting somebody or something. I'm not saying that you know, you can live this perfect life without hurting or touching anything. But to just become a little bit more conscious in the way that you're going and in the choices that you're making, and to see what the alternatives are, which are perhaps less destructive. Mm-hmm. And also to understand that there is a very small number of companies and corporates in this world that are responsible for 80% of a lot of the problems. And to also like educate yourself then on how can you change this. I'm not saying anyone's the enemy. They probably started out because of jobs and livelihoods and all of it. So no one is the enemy. Everybody has a reason, as I said, a story for doing what they do. But right now we're in a situation of chaos. And what can be done to try and avert this disaster? What can be done to kind of reduce this moral burden? What can be done to live more sustainably? And one of the biggest steps we have to take is to completely reimagine our relationship with this planet.
Completely. And that brings me on to how your story evolved from going from India and the forests and beaches of India to South Africa and the sea life of the South Coast.
to keep it down. So for me as a child, you know, as I said, I was incredibly lucky, so privileged to have, you know, this wonderful person who took me out into nature. The fact that I had time and I lived in a simpler time and I had all this access and I could go out into nature. And then the fact that I made that my profession and my job, and I went out and did what I did with the work that I did, traveling the length and breadth of India. But I had my own one big reservation, which was my fear of water. Because I nearly drowned as a child. But coming to Cape Town and then living on the banks, you know, literally on the doorstep of the Great Atlantic Ocean and this wonderful wild kelp ecosystem here, the Great African Sea Forest, and seeing how much joy that ecosystem brought Craig, my husband, and everyone else in the Sea Change Project when they'd go in the water every day, that kind of inspired me to start accessing that wilderness myself. It took me a long time because fear is a funny thing and it still governs me a lot sometimes when I go in the water. But the joy that I saw that was, you know, and this incredible ecosystem of this kelp forest, it's like an underwater forest, and the beauty, the animals, the peace. So, you know, my fear has turned more to wonder. So that's been my own personal journey where I had to change that and become sort of acquainted with this very, very new ecosystem for me, which was the ocean. Because even culturally, when I was a child in India, we didn't have a culture where we swam in the ocean or went to the beach, spent the whole day there in the water. We just didn't do that culturally. Mm-hmm. So it was both. It was the cultural barrier and there was the fear barrier. And that was my own arc in how I came here and got involved. Plus, as a journalist or as a storyteller, when you want to tell a story, you want it to be as authentic as possible. When I tell you a story, Yasmin, you will know in 2 seconds if that story is going to appeal to you emotionally or not. If I'm inauthentic, if I've made it up, if it's a secondhand story, I'm telling you someone else's story. If I'm paraphrasing something, but if I am telling you something I have seen, I have touched, I have experienced, I have felt, and what it's done for me to change my life, then that authenticity reaches across and touches the other person. You know, so I didn't understand. So for when I was as a conservationist, I said, how can I speak for ocean conservation? How can I speak for the conservation of the kelp forest? How can I speak for the Great African Sea Forest if I didn't experience it for myself? I had to be in it and I had to experience it in order to be able to speak for it. So that's been my own sort of journey and arc.
Yeah. And what was your experience of the kelp forest, as in, a lot of people find it a scary place to be because there's sharks and whatnot, and it's dark and it looks kind of, my eyes keep going towards the picture behind you. It's quite mystical looking. I mean, what kind of experience was it getting to understand that ecosystem?
It's actually, a lot of people even here who live in Cape Town and who swim in the ocean do get a little bit freaked out by the kelp because they, you know, the fronds do cover your body and you sort of slither through the fronds and you sort of swim through the kelp stipes and all of that. So a lot of people, even the people who live here and go in the water, are a little bit freaked out by the kelp. For me, it was really the water that was the problem in terms of that I couldn't swim and that I had fear of water. The actual environment didn't scare me. So for me, the kelp was actually a savior because it's this it's like a buoyant floating device. It's this massive forest, especially in low tide. If you just hold on to it, you can literally just float on top of the surface, holding on to this thing, and it keeps you afloat. Yeah. It's like wearing a giant, like, floating vest, you know, and being on the surface of the water. So it actually gave me a lot of confidence, and it gave me a lot of courage to enter the water. I don't know if I would have ever entered the ocean and become a diver and a swimmer if it wasn't for the kelp forest. Mm-hmm. It's because I knew I could find shelter in it, and I knew I could hold on to it if I got scared, and I knew it would help me float, that it actually even got me into the water. And the kelp forest is a nearshore ecosystem, so it's not far out in the ocean, in the deep and dark somewhere. It really starts within the first couple of meters of the rocky shores and stretches out to sometimes maybe 100 meters in, depending on how much of the rocky substrata actually goes out into the ocean, sometimes further, but sometimes a lot closer. So because kelp as a plant, it's not like a regular plant, it's an algae, you know, and it doesn't have a root system, not like it drops roots like a tree does and then grows. It has a hold fast system. So it kind of clings onto a rocky substrata, like, you know, it needs rocks, sediments to basically hold on to. And then the stipe is filled with air, so it kind of floats up to the top, so it allows it to reach for the sun, as because key as well, it uses, you know, the sun for photosynthesis, yeah. And it, of course, converts carbon into biomass, as do, you know, most living things. A lot of plant and algae forms on this planet. So kelp is a very, very interesting algae, and it's like, for a lot of people, they just see it on the surface and it looks all brown and they think, ooh, it must be all like, you know, like, I don't know, slimy and slippery and stuff. But it isn't. It's really soft and silky, and it kind of glides over your skin. And a lot of people fear when they swim that, ooh, I'm going to get stuck or I'm going to get trapped. I feel the exact opposite. I feel very protected when I swim through the forest because I can feel the fronds, and I know at any time I can just hold on to them. And when you pull yourself down on the stipe as you free dive down and you get to under and you look up, it's this massive canopy above you and these stipes rising around you, and you're in this incredible three-dimensional place. So think of a forest on land, a beautiful forest that you've visited. Now imagine all of the birds and animals and everything in that forest are flying around you and doing their thing. And this whole thing is covered in water, and you're one of the birds that is flying through this space in a three-dimensional way, looking at this beauty. That's what it's like in the Great African Sea Forest beneath the waves. So it's mm-hmm. wonderfully extraordinary. Yeah, it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And I have to say that in any situation with animals, be it sharks, be it tigers, be it leopards, be it a dog or a cat, in any situation, 9 times out of 10, the human is responsible for the reaction of the animal. Mm-hmm. It's just in any situation, just remember, if you are careful, if you are respectful, if you're not trying to be a cowboy, if you're not trying to prove a point, if you're not trying to, you know, challenge something, invariably, it's a 100% okay. When things go wrong, it's because you've crossed a line or pushed a boundary that you shouldn't have. Yeah.
And I guess that's something that you've learned from doing the work that you have in documentary. And I know you've done also done an interesting documentary on how humans communicate with or can communicate with animals and the indigenous connection with animals. And I also found that really fascinating.
Yeah. So a lot of the things that I'm saying, for example, about this reimagining our relationship with nature, the visceral connection that I'm talking about, this idea that we are nature, not the idea, the fact. All of this that I'm talking about is very much part of indigenous wisdoms. These aren't some new ideas that I've invented or someone else has invented. This has been part of human reality since humans became, you know, a species on this planet, really. And so when I did the film, My Animal Communicator, that was a sort of pushing it to an extreme form of communication. Any and every creature on this planet, all species, you live in sentience with the planet. You know, there are flowers that bloom at night because they can feel the full moon rising. You know, clams will open and close at a certain time of the day because they feel a certain rise of the moon or the position of the moon or the position of the tides. Fish know where to go during migration and when to spawn and when to give birth to their young because they understand the currents and they read the water temperatures. And so there's a great around us, you know, and it's working the whole time. And the human animal, as an animal on this planet, we know it too. It's just because we cut ourselves off physically from the environment. And we live in these artificial environments, and we control the temperature with heaters and air conditioners, and we control the rising and setting of the sun with electricity, and we control everything around us in how much of a control we think that we have. Mm-hmm. And that we've kind of dulled ourselves down to that very basic communication that we used to have with nature. So for indigenous people who track, so example, the art of tracking, when you're following animal tracks, and when you are hunting and gathering, and your survival depends on being able to track that animal down for that day's hunt to feed your family and your community. Not only are you very, very aware, and to be able to track an animal, the only way you can do it is if you knew everything about it. And the only way to know everything about it is to, from when you're a child, to have like generations of knowledge passed to you and to go tracking with your elders. You know, it's your life. This is what you do. So there is that visceral connection. So in the animal communicator, we just explored that as the idea of, where do you take this connection further? Can we actually have deep connections in terms of almost like an information exchange with the animal? And I found that some people can. And the reason they can is because they've taken the time and effort and they've done it. They've spent thousands upon thousands upon thousands of hours out in nature, paying attention, living wild, and really, really, really focusing on developing that skill. It's like any other skill. Why can a ballet, you know, a dancer do something that I can't? I can't go tomorrow and do like a piece in ballet. But if I practice for 10,000 hours, I can. Mm. You know, so it's like any other skill. It's not like something woo-woo or whoa, that's all in the realm of, you know, the not knowing. It's not true. It's just they've trained themselves to be able to do it. And for me, when I made the film Animal Communicator, more than convincing people that, oh, you can talk to an animal and it can talk back to you, there are only two things I wanted people to really take away from it. The one is the general sentience in the world around you, that you human are not the only so-called intellectual sentient being on this planet. All life around you is sentience. Every little animal that lives around you, every little plant that lives around you has its own wonderful life cycle, little internal drama, life, you know, predator, prey, survival, everything going on in its own little way, in its own little world. So that's number one. And number two, to understand then, if there is all this sentience around you, then to just deal with this world with greater compassion. Just step into this world with greater compassion, you know, because everything is alive and everything is living and everything has a right to be here as much as you do. So to have both those kind of notions, I really wanted for people to feel from the film. And the third notion was really to understand that this idea of communication isn't just the very conventional idea of exchanging words, but just putting yourself in a space to understand, as I said, that you are viscerally connected to nature yourself and that your entire system and being is connected to the way things work. Mm-hmm. And so to have that really become, yeah, it's something I wanted people to think about. So that's was one of the big motivations into making that film.
I love how you use storytelling as a way of connecting people with that kind of information. And that was something really clear for me in My Octopus Teacher, which is a film that you were recently part of. And it was almost like the octopus was a teacher and it was teaching us a lot. And that was kind of the central part of the documentary. But what came from that was so much, for me, it was like a light bulb moment of, we never talk about these sea forests and we never really hear about what they do for the environment. And it's the same with mangroves and any other kind of aqua ecosystem. They don't seem to get much of a recognition by conservationists as a place that holds so much potential for life and is so important to our ecosystem. So how do you kind of entwine your stories with these deep messages?
So the thing is, as humans, again, we spend most of our time on land. So there is a terrestrial bias. So obviously we see everything on land as more important. Why more important? Because I live on land. So therefore, of course, it's more important. Mm-hmm. If as humans we live like fish under the water, we'd be, you know, water biased. And we'd be more concerned about everything that would be happening in the ocean than it would on land. But what we need to understand while living on land is that the ocean is actually the gigantic sentience that's running our weather systems. It's the ocean that controls most of the climate. It's the ocean that produces over 70% of the world's oxygen. It's the ocean that's the biggest repository of species on the planet. It covers over 70% of this planet. So it's this absolutely crucial, connected, gigantic part of who we are. You know, to live on land, to have land be the way that it is, we need the ocean. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to kind of separate the two is almost like doing the entire thing a disservice, because you can never do conservation in silos. You know, you can't say, I'm going to protect this, but I'm going to forget about that. It just won't work. And I think conservationists for a long time have totally, it's not like they were not paying attention to the ocean. The biggest challenge with the ocean also was, I guess, access. So for scientists to go out there and understand it in the way that they can, forests and species on land, is more difficult. You know, how deep do you go? Where do you go? It's such a vast part of this planet. You know, to find, it's only very recently that can we dive to the depths of the Challenger Deep. And it's only very recently can humans with scuba tanks and stuff really spend more time underwater. It's only very recently that a lot of technology, in a sense, has helped humans kind of really explore and look at what's happening in the oceans. But having said that, even in that, we know more about the surface of Mars and the Moon than we know about the benthic layer or the deep ocean bed. We've mapped more of the surface of Mars and the Moon than we have of our own, you know, the ocean bed. We, of all the species in the ocean, only 10% have been described, which means 90% of the ocean species haven't even been described yet. And it's with that sliver of knowledge that we make all our decisions when it comes to the fishing industries and the whaling industries and all the things that we do to extract from the ocean, from that thin little bit of knowledge that we have. For example, with sharks, everybody knows of the great white shark. Everyone is terrified of the great white shark. Why? Because there was a movie called Jaws that came out and did an excellent job of telling a story that scared the bejesus out of people, right? So that one story just changed the way people looked at shark. That one story allowed for 200 million sharks to be slaughtered a year for their fins without too much emotional. Now, if the same thing happened to puppies, or it happened to bear cubs, or it happened to, you know, cute little animals that we think are cuddly and sweet, and that's the story Disney sells us, we'd lose our collective minds. Yeah. We don't care that 200 million sharks are being slaughtered because Jaws has made us so scared of the animal. Yeah. And yet, it's the most glorious apex predator on this planet. Sharks are what keep our oceans healthy. If we didn't have sharks, the oceans wouldn't be healthy. And we're messing with the system that controls our entire weather system and ultimately our climate. You know, so these are the kind of, everything is so connected. There's no way to like say, I'm going to keep yanking on this thread and I can yank on that thread and I can yank on this thread and we'll be fine and it's sustainable. It's not, because ultimately all these threads at some point come together to form the tapestry that we live in. And the whole thing's just going to unravel. So it's incredibly crucial. You know, soon it's never too late, I'd like to say, because I go in the ocean every day and I still feel a lot of hope. And this year has the decade for ocean sciences and ocean sustainability and regeneration. And hopefully that means there'll be a lot more attention to what's happening in our waters. A lot of amazing films have come out, like Seaspiracy and other films that are showing you the kind of exploitation the ocean's under. The film My Octopus Teacher, kind of what we wanted to show you was the possibility of when you're human and you make that enchanted connection and you make that deep emotional connection and you can be in that space, the possibilities that are ahead of you, the beauty that is ahead of you, the amount of healing it can bring you, the joy that it can bring you, the discovery that is there to be made, you know, the wonder, really. And between all of this, I think, hopefully, now at least there's more attention on the oceans than there was even a decade ago. But yeah, it's unfortunate that a lot of our decisions and a lot of the way we look at things are still very terrestrially biased. I would actually like for us to be known as Planet Earth Ocean and not just Planet Earth. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I've never even thought about it that way. I guess just because as humans, we are land dwellers, well, the ones that aren't born on the coast are. And we just forget that that is an entire world that, like you say, we know more about Mars than we do about what's in the oceans. And it's just insane to think about. But My Octopus Teacher really, I think it was quite emotive. So it was connecting us to that feeling of what you could get in the natural world and why it's so important to protect it. And it's exactly what you said about how children, like, how can we expect future generations to take care of this planet if they have, they don't have that, and they never had that kind of connection to the natural world. And yeah, I think that it did bring a lot of awareness towards the ocean and to kelp forests and to the animal kind of kingdom in general, as well as seaspiracy. Seaspiracy is an interesting one because it really showed what fisheries are doing to the oceans. And I was wondering what you would say the biggest threats to the kelp forests were at the moment.
Climate change.
Yeah.
Climate change is the singularly biggest threat because kelp forests ideally thrive in colder waters. That's why you find them in, you know, in all the latitude and longitudes that have colder currents coming in. So climate change, the warmer the oceans are, the more the kelp will struggle to survive. I would say the other threats are localized. So depending on the country that you're in, it could be that the kelp itself is being over-harvested for whatever resources it provides, or that there is an animal that lives in the forest that keeps the, that eats. So for example, in California, in some parts of California, kelp forests have vanished because sea otters were hunted to extinction and local extinction, and they didn't predate on the sea urchins that they used to predate on, which then ended up eating all the sort of new growing kelp and then created these massive urchin barrens. And in a country like Tasmania, where they've lost 95% of their kelp forest, is pretty much because of warming waters, where a kind of species of urchin that wasn't found there before shifted and then started to decimate the kelp forest. And this is the other thing that's happening all around the world, especially definitely in the oceans as well, is this shift that's happening because of temperature. So species that weren't found in a certain latitude or longitude are now being found there because they're being driven out of where they are because of increasing warmth. And they, as it then, you know, they move into a trophic zone that they don't belong in. And then those challenges come with challenges. And then that goes down the trophic zone. And then it gets more complicated. And then it moves up, you know, goes into the next latitude and the next longitude. And this constant sort of shifting is happening all over the world. And that's because of climate change. So just like anywhere else, yes, locally, again, maybe you have poaching. Maybe you have toxic chemical pollution. Maybe you have sewerage going into the water. You have plastic pollution. Overfishing, of course, is a problem anywhere in the world, everywhere in the world, actually. So it's a combination of all these things that become a challenge in different parts of the world to the kelp forest. It's quite a resilient ecosystem in one way, because it's an incredibly biodiverse ecosystem. And any ecosystem that's biodiverse has a range of protections to cope with the challenges that you throw at it. But if you throw too many challenges at it at the same time, while undermining its very structure with something as massive as climate change, then you can have very quick collapses and repercussions to what you're doing. And that would be like the biggest threat, is because you don't give that ecosystem time enough to recover. You don't allow it to have time enough to recover. It would be like saying you may be a very healthy human with a very healthy immunity, and you'll be able to fight off one virus, maybe two viruses and a bacteria, maybe something else. But if I'm going to give you bad food and I'm going to give you bad water, and on top of it, I'm going to inundate you with all of the viruses and the bacterias, and I'm going to put you under tremendous stress and depression and anxiety, no matter how healthy your immune system started out, you're going to collapse pretty fast. And that's what we're doing to ecosystems around the world right now. It's just we're hitting it with too many things at the same time. But having said that, what is wonderful about these ecosystems is also their ancient sentience, their ways of functioning. They know what they need to do to survive and thrive. So if you give them the time and you give them the protection and you give them that space to thrive, the turnaround is incredible. And that's what gives me hope. You know, being in the water and seeing that turnaround is incredible. So it's we still have the window. We have this decade, and we have a window to protect what is left on this planet. That should be number one. And to allow for other places that still have some hope to regenerate and thrive and come back, to allow it to regenerate and thrive and come back. So that's really where we are at.
And it's nice to kind of end with some sort of hope always. I find a lot of environmental journalism very hard to stomach because it kind of just lays out a lot of what's wrong and then leaves us feeling a bit like, well, now what?
What do you do? What can I I do, yeah. or what's the solution? Just remember, you know, I just feel like we still, you know, do we have the same wonderful kind of robust ecosystems we had even when our grandfathers were alive? Did they see the same kind of wonderful, robust ecosystems that their grandfathers saw? No. So it's diminishing with every generation. And that is the danger. But the hope is also that we still have this wonderful ecosystem. We still have kelp forests. We still have biodiversity in these kelp forests. We still have the opportunity, the window, the time to protect what we have and to make a difference and to change things. And that's true of any ecosystem that is still existing. The Amazon today may be on fire. A lot of the parts of the Amazon is actually releasing more carbon in the air than it's sequestering. The Amazon in its own way creates microclimates and causes rain in parts of the world. And that's changing the weather in South America. And all of these challenges are happening there. But there's still parts of the Amazon that exist. There's still parts that are incredibly biodiverse. What it takes is political will and people. We need to understand that this biosphere, without it, we're dead. That's number one. But more important than that, look at this world around us, this beauty, this sentience, this life. You know, we have a moral obligation to not mess with it in the way that we're messing with it. You know, regardless of our own survival or regardless of what it does for us or not, its intrinsic value is so extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, it deserves to thrive in its own right. So to me, that's really where we need to find the inspiration, the hope and the balance. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the beauty about it is just watching how quickly nature bounces back when you just leave it. And it's almost quite simple. As humans, we just need to stop doing what we're doing. It's almost like we don't actually need to do much. We just need to stop consuming, stop relying on like economics to save us or whatnot. It's just let it be, let it do its thing and coexist. Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to add?
I think we've covered a lot and it's all good. And yeah, in terms of adding anything, just the most important thing personally for me that nature gave me and taught me was, I guess, this idea or this absolute deep sense that I belong. Mm-hmm. I am the human animal. I'm phylum Chordata, class Mammalia, kingdom Animalia. This is my world. This is my home. It doesn't matter that I'm a brown girl from India and I will travel tomorrow to the United States or to England or wherever. Sure, we have nation states and borders and passports that tell you where you can enter and where you can't. But that's human constructs. I belong on this planet. It doesn't matter. My skin color doesn't matter. My religion doesn't matter. My political beliefs don't matter. None of it matters. What nature tells you is you're a child of this planet and you belong, you know? So to me, that is the most powerful sort of message that I've always felt like when I'm in wild spaces. That's what makes wild spaces and wild animals so precious, is because that sense of belonging. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Swati, for joining us today. Really loved talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you everyone for listening. If you wish to connect or have a story to share, please feel free to get in contact with me, your host Jasmine, via the earthwitness.news website. You can also contact us through the UK Health Radio website. I hope you enjoyed this interview and thank you for listening.